Welcome to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you missed any of my Talk Radio breakfast show, don't worry. We've put some of the punchiest bits of this morning's show into a bite-sized podcast, the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. Enjoy.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Nick Gibb, good morning to you.
Good morning, Julia.
Oh, good morning. Lovely to have your company this morning. Well, 4 out of 10 schools in England apparently going back today, the rest going back over the coming days. Any school that doesn't reopen, any teacher who doesn't return to work without a very good health reason, what's going to happen to them?
Well, my understanding from the NAHT surveys and our own surveys up and down with our regional teams is that all schools will be opening. And whether or not individual teachers return to work, that's a matter between the teacher and the head teacher. But I'm confident that we'll have schools opening and that parents will be sending their children into school. It's important for their mental health that they are in school with their friends. And it's important for their long-term life chances that they resume their education in schools. And schools have gone to enormous lengths over the summer, based on our guidance that we issued in early July, to make sure that the schools are safe, with extra hand sanitizers in classrooms, with more hand basins, with bubbles to keep children from unnecessarily mixing with other children beyond those bubbles, one-way systems in schools, staggered lunch and breaks and playtime breaks, and also that the staff have been kept safe as well by having a 2-meter gap between the front row in a classroom and the teachers themselves. So huge measures to keep both pupils and teachers safe in the school.
What do you make of a criticism of a head teacher we spoke to earlier, Alan Brooks? He's Kent Association of Head Teachers chair. He said to me that the advice from the government has been remarkably inconsistent on the reopening of schools, and things have been very last minute. We've seen lots of changes. We saw, didn't we, ahead of the bank holiday weekend, Friday night, new guidance issued on what schools should do in the event of a high rate of coronavirus in the local area and a local lockdown and the like. What do you make of that criticism? Actually, the help from the central government has been rather inconsistent.
Well, the advice about opening schools was published on the 2nd of July, and that's over 2 months. That's 2 months ago, and that's what schools have been using as a basis for the preparations they're making for this week. In terms of the guidance issued on Friday, that is about what happens in local areas when a school has to close. No schools are closed as a consequence of any of the local lockdowns at the moment. All schools, even in those areas, will be open and children will be safe to return to those schools. So the guidance that came out on Friday, it has to go through all kinds of clearance processes. It has to have the most up-to-date medical and scientific advice, and it has to be cleared by all those specialists within government before it's published. But we do publish these guidance as soon as we possibly can, and that's why it went out late Friday evening. But again, that relates to later, when and if there are reasons for schools to have to close.
Well, if schools do close, will we finally be prepared to make sure that all of the children who need lessons are getting lessons? We had a big issue with lots of very disadvantaged children, those who most need education to help them with their lives ahead, missing out on lessons the most, partly because, frankly, some schools didn't do their job, but also because a lot of kids simply didn't have the equipment. They haven't got broadband at home, they haven't got a laptop, they haven't got an iPad. Your government were very keen on the whole idea that, we were going to find laptops, handing out laptops and iPads to kids galore. But most of those didn't actually appear until almost the end of term. Are you actually prepared for schools to close again and have all that equipment ready?
Well, we procured over 200,000 computers in a very demanding global marketplace where everybody wants these items. It was one of the biggest procurements of computers in this country, and they were delivered on time to local authorities and to school trusts.
We've on time? Also what was when was on time then? When did the first ones arrive with schools?
Well, some of them were there in June, and then over the period of June and July.
When did schools close, Minister?
But let me just
When did schools close?
They closed towards the end of July.
Schools closed in March, and you're saying that you got 200,000, well, some of the 200,000 screens to kids, well, to schools, and then handed on to kids in June. I've got to be honest with you, I could pop to my local Currys and get one quicker than that.
No, well, you couldn't have popped into the local Currys and bought 200,000 computers. They had to be built from scratch. It was one of the most successful.
Why did they have to be built from scratch?
Because you can't get 200,000. all the shops combined would not have 220,000 computers available. We procured them on the global market. They were built, they were transported. Some days, over 20,000 a day were being distributed to schools and local authorities. It was a hugely successful operation. And since then, we have acquired another 150,000 in reserve for circumstances where a school has to close, and then they'll be distributed to those schools for those disadvantaged young people who may not have computers at home. But now we want young people back in school. That's where they are best equipped to catch up on the lost education they had. And I'm confident that pupils will be returning to school. We had we've funded schools £1 billion, a catch-up fund to help schools fund that extra tuition that their pupils will need to catch up, and a special within that £350 million for a national tutoring program for the most disadvantaged young people, one-to-one and small group tuition, which is a very effective way of ensuring that those young people can catch up.
Okay, can you understand why a lot of people, though, who would be largely supportive? I've known you for many years, Minister, and I have absolute faith that genuinely that you want the best for all kids to get a good education, and particularly disadvantaged kids. I know this is a mission for you. I absolutely accept your good intentions. But do you understand why a lot of people, even people who voted for your government in December, will be just sort of deep sighing or indeed tearing their hair out at what the government has done? You're saying, you know, the catch-up fund. We had all this talk about, you know, say the laptops, the screens going out. That was March. They didn't go out until June at the earliest. And then we had a whole load of talk about there were going to be summer schools. Well, they didn't happen. And the schools were going to go back, but they weren't going to wear masks. Well, now some of them are allowed to wear masks, and you have to wear a mask in this scenario or that scenario. We weren't going to move exams. Now we are. And we weren't, you know, there have been so many, you can call them U-turns or policy changes, that an awful lot of parents and teachers who may have been very supportive are losing faith that this government does know what it's doing in this area. Do you not think that is a reasonable concern for people to have?
Look, none of the decisions that we've had to take during this pandemic have been easy. Every decision is a challenge. It's a challenge to close schools, to cancel exams, to bring about a method of allocating grades that's fair and consistent between schools. We have to base every decision on the latest medical and scientific advice. So when we change our view on things like face masks being worn in communal areas of schools, that's because World Health Organization advice changes. And on the basis of that, our own scientific advice change in relation to the particular circumstances of this country. And as soon as we get that advice, we change the advice to schools. This is never going to be a smooth journey as we tackle the consequences of the coronavirus. But what you can be assured of is that we will do everything it takes to make sure schools are safe. Every school has been delivered a small number of home testing kits. Every school is going to be delivered a small quantity of personal protection equipment. And all schools have put in place, I've gone to enormous lengths to put in place, protective, clean hygiene measures, hand sanitizers, extra wash basins, one-way systems, staggered lunch breaks, and so on. All the measures have been put in place to make sure children are kept safe within the school. So, you know, the government is doing what it takes to get things done. But of course, it's never going to be smooth. There will be changes of advice. There will be changes of policy as the science and what we know about this virus changes.
Let's talk about the changes to exams. We saw massive changes going on about how the exams were going to be marked this year, and I'd like to come back to that. But in terms of next year's exams, the likes of the chair of the Education Select Committee, Robert Halfen, of course himself a Tory MP, saying, look, you need to have, you know, absolutely clear instructions within the next week or so of what is going to happen with the exams next year. Labour Party been calling for those exams to be delayed. Is the plan now to delay those exams that would normally take place in May and June to as far late as just to July? And how is that going to work when it comes to university applications for those youngsters doing A-levels?
Well, we wrote to the regulator in mid-June asking them to work with the exam boards, work with the department to find a way of increasing the amount of teaching time for those young people taking GCSEs and A-levels, including looking at delaying the actual exam season next summer. There are issues to consider, as you hinted, at issues of the time it takes to mark them, the lead time that universities need for applications. And there's also the issue within the United Kingdom of the other nations that use GCSEs, Wales, Northern Ireland, about their term dates as well. So there are a whole range of factors that we have been looking at over the last few weeks in order to increase teaching time. And also, the regulator consulted on how you assess students next year to reduce the burden of that assessment for the exam process itself, again, to free up more teaching time.
And then it's saying an element of coursework this year, and also, you know, hey, here's an idea, kids, do work before your mock exams this time round. It may well matter. What about the issue over the exams this year? We had the teachers made the assessments, and then basically across the board, we were going to have a whole load of kids doing an awful lot better than they normally would. And then we had the algorithm to try and sort of mark those kids down to what they would probably have got in real time. And of course, then lots of kids walk down. It affected disadvantaged kids more than private school kids. And then the government basically said, go back, you can just have the marks that you already had from the schools. However, there is a group of pupils who've been ignored by this, because there is a right of appeal if you're unhappy with what you've got, unless your school did, this is, I mean, it's a complicated term, the CAGS, this is, of course, the centre, what is it called? The centre assessment grade. So when your school basically assessed you as saying, we think you're going to get a C grade, but actually, when they actually made an allowance for what the school normally delivers, they worked out that actually on average, someone would have got a D grade and they gave you a D. You can't appeal that D grade. You can only appeal it if it was the algorithm that Ofqual had that forced you down. Are you going to allow kids? I mean, there are kids I've seen online who say they've missed out on a place at medical school. They were expecting A's. They got downgraded to B's. They've missed out on their place. Yes, they can retake the exams, but they can't get into medical school this year and the like. Isn't it not fair that the youngsters who had their grades downgraded by their school, who basically applied this algorithm effectively themselves in advance, that they should also have a right of appeal?
Well, this is something that the exam boards have been looking at. The regulator published quite detailed guidance about the grounds for appeal, and your assessment of that advice is correct. Schools can't appeal on the basis of the judgments that the teachers made, or indeed the adjustments that the school will have made to make sure that they were consistent year on year. But if the school can demonstrate that somehow that the data that is being used is wrong, they can appeal on the basis of wrong data. These are difficult decisions. We wanted to have a consistency between schools. The model that the regulator used was published. They consulted widely on it. It had a lot of support from across the school system. But what went wrong was how that model, which is the right approach to ensuring consistency, what went wrong was how that model then translated through the algorithm into actual grades. And we saw some of the terrible results that we saw when the A-levels came out. That's why the regulator took swift action, and the recalculated grades were with schools within 48 hours of the recalculation happening. Okay. But in terms of the judgments that schools made, they were correctly using the model that had been consulted on, that had widespread support in the school sector, to make sure that a school's results were consistent with the results that they had achieved in recent years. And if that data on which those judgments are made is wrong, then that is a grounds.
It's not the data. The schools are the most honest. Their pupils are the ones who've suffered the most, which seems unfair. Just finally, and I know I need to let you go at 9:19, but Marcus Rashford, he forced a U-turn from the government on school holiday vouchers for free school meals. He's now written to MPs saying he's signed up with Aldi and Tesco, Deliveroo and Kellogg's to form a group called the Child Food Poverty Task Force. Are you willing to work with Marcus Rashford and these organisations to try and tackle this issue? Obviously, it's a massive issue for schools, children who don't get the right nutrition.
Yes, of course. And we share the objective. We don't want to see the poverty and the hunger that Marcus Rashford talks about in his letter. We share that same objective. And that's why all the measures that we put in place to protect jobs and incomes during the lockdown were so important. And the extra money we put into the welfare system, an extra £1,000 a year on universal credit, and we will work, and we will look at the policies that Rashford has suggested in his letter to see whether it's the most effective way on delivering those objectives. Interestingly, Julia, in his letter, he talks about, very compellingly actually, about his own personal experience growing up, and he says in his letter it was only his success at football that helped him and his family to pull out of that situation. And what I would say is that for most people, the only way out of poverty is education. And that's why I'm, as you said earlier, so passionate about making sure that the education that's available to people, young people from disadvantaged backgrounds, is of the same quality as the education that people from wealthier backgrounds take for granted. That's why I've focused so much, and the government has focused since 2010 on improving the reading, where reading is taught, the maths is taught, that you, more young people are taking those core academic subjects, you know, languages, science, history, geography, English and maths, that are taken for granted in more affluent parts of the country. And that's the objective of me, it's objective of the government, and it's objective of the Prime Minister to level up standards right across the country.
Nick Gibb, School Standards Minister.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio. Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. Talk Radio.
First up, though, let's talk about rather more important things that do matter, and that's getting schools reopened. 4 out of 10 schools in England go back today. The rest are hopefully in the next couple of days. But keeping them open safely is a national priority. Who says that? Well, Toby Perkins, Shadow Education Minister and Labour MP, who joins us right now. Good morning to you, Toby.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. I mean, obviously, this is such a priority, not just for children's education, but getting parents back in the workplace as well, getting the kids back to school 6 months after the schools were closed. What do you think the top priority for the government should be, and indeed head teachers, right now?
Well, the absolute priority needs to be to make sure that everything that can be done to ensure that schools are safe is being done. That's partly about having a testing and tracing regime people can have confidence in. It's also about trying to make sure that schools are given all the support they need to make their environment safe. And one of the things that we're calling for is that all head teachers, that all schools should have a mask policy in communal areas, rather than it being left open to head teachers to make a choice and it being different in two different schools 50 yards apart, as could currently happen. So that's the real priority, to get schools back to get children back to school, because the consequences for children not being at school are very significant.
Indeed. There was a mask policy in communal areas. It was they shouldn't wear masks at all in school. And that was the advice of the chief medical officer and the deputy chief medical officer. And then Nicola Sturgeon decided to change her policy and insist on a requirement that children wear masks in communal areas. Given that we know how little the virus can affect children, and how little children in other countries have been spreading the virus to their teachers and at home as a result of going back, why do you think that we need to have masks worn in communal areas by children?
Well, the WHO advice on this did change. So you're right that previously the advice had been against that. But about 2 weeks ago, the WHO advice did change on that. I think that in terms of older children, 12 plus, there is a lot of evidence that they, whilst they don't get that ill with it themselves, they are likely to transmit and pass on the virus. And every step that can be taken to protect children's education must be taken. And you know, we think masks are a sensible part of a mediation strategy to prevent transmission of coronavirus.
Do you think that parents who refuse to send their children to school, we know something like a third of parents say they're concerned about the safety in schools, do you think that they should face fines?
No, I don't. That shouldn't be the priority for government. I think that a lot more needs to be done to work with parents to ensure they're confident. It is important the message goes out that children should be in school, that government and schools are working hard to make sure that the school environment is safe, and that parents should have confidence to send their children back. But if due to their personal circumstances there's a particular reason why they're not, then the school should be working closely with the parent about why it's important to get them back, about the consequences of not going back, but also to try and alleviate any health concerns they have, rather than the sort of the stick of a fines regime.
Well, apart from the fact that, look, you know, I'm a parent, my kid's going back to school this Thursday, I can't wait, she can't wait. Chief Medical Officer tells us it's safe for kids to go back. Got to be honest with you, he's got rather more expertise than I or most parents have got. That's good enough for me. Why should schools spend their time trying to cajole and convince parents who quite clearly aren't looking at the medical and scientific evidence and haven't listened to all the reassurance that has come out from people who do know a lot better than them, who say, oh, I don't think it's safe? If they don't send their kids to school, they're breaking the law. The schools are open. shouldn't they face a fine? Wouldn't that focus minds and be rather less effort for the schools?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, you don't know the health circumstances of individuals.
No. If someone's shielding, then there need to be, you know, some sort of measures in place.
Exactly.
That won't be the vast majority of parents in this situation. You know that, and I know that.
Well, the vast majority of children will be going back, and I think the vast majority of parents will welcome that. But all I'm saying is that, you know, I can't sit here in London and tell you what the case is in every single child, every single family's environment. And I think at this moment, after the shock we've been through, you know, the priority needs to be giving parents confidence rather than trying to find them.
I just don't know how you're going to give confidence to people who have not, to this point, listened to the facts.
Well, I mean, I think it is important that that we do everything we can to get the medical evidence across to them. I agree with that. But the fact is that the government's advice has been changing so many times.
That's true.
There is a lack of confidence in the Department of Education, in the Education Secretary, that when he says something on Monday, it's still what he believes by Wednesday. So, you know, I can understand that. But the message from the Labour Party, having worked closely with schools, is that, you know, there is a real damage to children being done by not being in schools. And therefore, we want parents to feel confident to get their children back in.
Now, your boss, the Shadow Education Secretary, Kate Green, was talking about exams being delayed yesterday. It looks like, once again, another U-turn, another move from Gavin Williamson, the Education Secretary, hinting yesterday that, they are looking at exams move. When do you want exams, the GCSEs and the A-levels, when do you want them moved to? Currently, those exams normally would be May and June. Are you suggesting they move all the way to July, the end of the summer term? Past the end of the summer term, how long, much longer do you think children need to catch up those lessons?
Well, I think the evidence in terms of how far children are behind is that on average about 3 months, that it's probably more than that in terms of children from more deprived communities. But we couldn't afford for exams to be delayed for that long. So alongside a delay in exams, there needs to be a real programme put in place to support children to catch up. I think we've been suggesting somewhere like late June, early July, but there needs to be a lot of work done on both sides of this equation. Firstly, to see how much time is needed. Secondly, to see what needs to be put in place to support the qualification assessment regime to ensure that we get results early enough for students to then move on from those results to be able to get to university by September, October. So, you know, there is a lot of work that needs to be done here, and that's what civil servants are for. But we're just getting out there in front saying, you know, government needs to be putting in place a delay, exactly how long they need to work on. And I'm welcome the fact that government's language appears to be changing today, and they appear to be moving towards going to that position. I suspect they will end up there with exams delayed. But the sooner they do that, the sooner that students and teachers know what they're talking about.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
But front page of loads of the newspapers today is a picture of Adele, the new slimline Adele, of course, looking absolutely fantastic. And let's not forget that, of course, her biggest sin always has been that she actually lost weight. Not allowed to do that, ladies, because then you upset the fatties fit brigade. But she's got in trouble. Because she posted a photograph of herself as a long-time, you know, born Londoner, basically celebrating the Notting Hill Carnival that didn't happen this last bank holiday weekend. She wore her lovely Jamaican flag patterned bikini. She had her hair in what's called bantu knots, little knots on top of her head with a big yellow feather behind her. She's now at the centre of a storm over what apparently is a controversial hairstyle and has been accused of cultural appropriation. An American journalist, Ernest Owens, who is himself black, said if 2020 couldn't get any more bizarre, Adele is giving us bantu knots and cultural appropriation that nobody asked for. This officially marks all of the top white women in pop as problematic. Hate to see it. She has, however, been defended by Naomi Campbell and others. But what is cultural appropriation, and what right does anyone have to say that anyone else can't have a particular hairstyle or hair colour? Let's talk about this with Inayaya Folarin Eman. She's a columnist at Spiked Online and founder of the Equiano Project, a project seeking to promote free speech, particularly on issues of race. Good morning to you, Inayaya.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I have to say, when I see these stories, I do despair, especially when the newspapers or the online articles will talk about controversial hairstyles and things like that. There's nothing controversial about any hairstyle. We decided earlier on the show that perhaps if she'd had a swastika sort of shaved into her head, yes, that would be controversial. But sporting a particular kind of short braid, how is that controversial?
It is just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, it just shows the contradictions in so much of these arguments. On the one hand, we hear that, oh, you know, certain cultures are being marginalised and they're not getting enough attention. And then on the other hand, when certain other cultures become internationalised and we celebrate the kind of diversity of hairstyles and dress and food, that's so-called problematic. I mean, you really can't win. If we were to kind of go through every single thing in the world and find out its origins, we would never be able to do that. That's impossible. We welcome celebration of different cultures and all different people enjoying the fruits of other people.
But this is it. It's the idea that there's one culture, again, what do you mean by culture, owns a hairstyle or owns a style of food. I thought one of the people who are massively into sort of diversity of race and religion and culture, they're the people saying how wonderful it is because we can have, say, a wonderfully diverse culture and see people and meet with people who have very diverse appearances and the like and eat different food and the like. And yet we're told, but we must admire it, but we must not partake of it if we've committed the terrible sin of being white and British. But what's fascinating is, again, is an American commenting on a British woman celebrating a British festival and all the culture around that, which I find utterly bizarre, bearing in mind also that the Bantu knots are apparently an African style of hair. But what's interesting, we never seem to see the same criticism of, say, someone like Beyoncé, a black pop star who wears long blonde hair, which is, I mean, I'm sure maybe it is possible for black women to naturally have that hair. I'm not aware of that. It's not my area of expertise. I have no issue whatsoever with any hairstyle that any woman of any colour chooses to have. Not my business. Don't care. But why is it that Adele gets attacked for having a supposedly African hairstyle, but Beyoncé has a supposedly white woman's blonde hairstyle, and no one criticises her? What are the rules when it comes to controversial hairstyles?
Well, I don't think there is any rules. I think it's a self-appointed group of people that choose to be the spokesperson for the entirety of humanity and decide what is and isn't acceptable. And what they really want to do is keep people in their silos, keep people in very rigid categories. And what they say, stay in your lane, never leave the kind of category to which they kind of impose upon you. And I think what is really revealing is actually what many people have been saying for several months now, which is the dangers of importing wholesale the American racial culture wars to Britain, yeah, when it's a completely different context. You know, this person clearly has no idea about the festivals and the culture and all of the different things that happen in Britain, such as Notting Hill Carnival, and has taken it upon himself to judge people when he knows nothing about it. And actually what's been very positive on this particular situation, which has been rare, is that we have seen quite a significant pushback,
yes,
from, as you said, Naomi Campbell. Many black Brits are saying, you don't know what you're talking about, this is completely fine. And actually, you know, Adele grew up in London, there's nothing,
yeah,
wrong.
And yet again, even the justifications for her doing it, the fact that, well, black people have said it's okay, or, well, but she's from London, it's not, in a way, those are also problematic. I don't, she can be from sodding Switzerland for all I care. She's still allowed to have whatever darn haircut she wants. People don't own, ethnicity doesn't own a haircut. And it seems to me that the vast majority of people of whatever colour will find this bizarre. And yet we talk about it. Now, part of me says I shouldn't talk about it because I'm in a way making it more of a story by talking about it. But when it's on the front page of virtually every newspaper and they've put it on there because they know, you know, she is a huge star, people want to see pictures of her. The fact that the word controversial can be used about a hairstyle tells us that we do have a battle to fight. And if we don't address this and we don't call it out for what it is, which is, I mean, frankly, I think an awful lot of this is just misogynism. I really think a lot of this is just men who hate women and just want to criticise a woman for every single thing. But also, this is racism. If you're saying that a white woman can't do something because of the colour of her skin, I'm sorry, that's racism.
No, I completely agree with you. I do think it's racism. I actually think it's very dangerous because, you know, how can we ever move forward if the only reason somebody can't do something is because of the colour of their skin? Yeah. I think that is completely stupid.
It's also what the white supremacists want us to have, isn't it? I mean, we're all playing into their hands.
Oh, exactly. You can't fight racism with racism. And this is literally what these people are promoting. And it will only lead to further division. I think whatever your culture is, whatever your colour is, if you want to enjoy something that might originate somewhere else, that is your prerogative. Feel free to do that. The more mixing and integration we have, the better, in my view.
Online, on DAB and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and give me a good review. And don't forget to catch me on the Talk Radio Breakfast Show every weekday from 6:30 until 10.